All right, welcome to Making the Argument. Before we get started, I have a very important announcement. We have a brand new deal with GoodRanchers.com. That's right. If you go into Good Ranchers and you use promo code Nick and you sign up for one of their subscriptions, you're not only going to get $15 off, but do you remember the old deal where you got 2 pounds of ground beef with each order? Well, we just upped the game. That's right. You can choose top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon now. Every single order you get on that subscription is going to come with free top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon. You get to choose which one if you use promo code Nick. And again, $15 off on top of that. That's a savings of $480 in meat by signing up for one of those subscriptions. Not to mention the fact that if you are looking for a gift for someone that is impossible to shop for, you can go on to goodranchers.com and get one of their brand new gift boxes. Now, this is a limited time only offer. It's part of their overall Black Friday special. So go on to goodranchers.com to get more details. Sign up for promo code Nick in order to get that deal, and let's get on with the show.
Hi, this is Nick Freitas, and welcome back to Making the Argument. So, just as I have promised in previous episodes, if people ask us questions or they send in, things that they would like us to discuss on Making the Argument, we do respond. So if you like, share, and comment, you might have an episode dedicated exactly to one of your questions. So one of the questions I've been asked a lot about is, as I formulated my own worldview and my own, opinions and ideas about policy, philosophy, et cetera, who are some of the people that have been the most influential on me? What are some of the books that people should read? And so we're actually going to make this a whole series. So kind of throughout Making the Argument throughout this year, we're going to dedicate certain episodes to particular thinkers that I think are incredibly important for anybody that wants to be able to make a good argument for conservative values, conservative philosophy, individual liberty, free markets, etc. And we are starting this off with someone that I think is probably the most appropriate because of all the contemporary thinkers that I could talk about, Thomas Sowell has probably had the greatest influence of any contemporary thinker with respect to my own worldview or the way that I think about political policy, whether it's economics or school choice, or things like rent control, right? Thomas Sowell has just been incredibly influential. And I have some books here. And we're going to go over kind of what some of these books are. So if you have a particular topic that you think is the most interesting, great, start with that one. But all I can tell you is that as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, you need to go and do some research, read Thomas Sowell, watch some interviews that he does, because the man is absolutely brilliant. And one of the things I find most interesting about Thomas Sowell is he didn't start off life as some champion of free market economics or individual liberty, far from it. He grew up very poor. His parents died when he was very young. He went to go live with family. He spent a lot of his youth up in New York, and he was a Marxist. I mean, he comes right out and says it. It's not that he doesn't just say he was a socialist or he believed in all these government. No, he was a straight up Marxist. And this is a guy that, again, his entire young life was disrupted by the death of his parents. And when he went to go live with family up in New York, he really credits them putting him in contact with a young man at the time that took him to the library and really encouraged his desire to read and to learn. Because again, it's not like Thomas Sowell had a lot of money. So going to the library at a very young age and beginning to read and check out books was instrumental for him. And again, this didn't make him a conservative. His whole life growing up in New York being everything from, a bicycle messenger. In fact, there's a great series that was just put out by the Hoover Institute about the life of Thomas Sowell that I really encourage you to watch. But he talks about his own transformation and why did he start off life as a Marxist. And one of the things he talks about is when he was working in New York City at the time, and he was a bicycle messenger, he said that every once in a while he would spring and he'd spend, I think it was a dime, to go on the bus that would take him through, Fifth Avenue, and then would cross into the poorer areas of New York City where he lived. And for him, he thought Karl Marx was the one that really explained kind of the wealth disparities within society and why was it that some people were incredibly wealthy and why were some incredibly poor. And he ended up getting accepted to Harvard. He finished his degree at Harvard, then he moved over to the University of Chicago. And here's what I find really interesting is that he was going into the whole field of policy, of economics, And he actually studied under Milton Friedman, who is somebody else that we'll be discussing on a later episode. But Milton Friedman is considered a champion of free market economics. In fact, if you watch the series Free to Choose, or you read the book Capitalism and Freedom by Milton Friedman, he does an excellent job of kind of laying out the differences between more of a capitalist, or really not capitalist, but a free market approach to the economy versus a centrally planned socialist or Marxist approach to the economy. So Thomas Sowell studied under Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago, got through all of his classes, and was still a Marxist, right? So what changed? Well, what changed was Thomas Sowell spent a summer working for the government down in Puerto Rico. He was working as an intern with distributing welfare programs to the people living down in Puerto Rico. And he wanted to determine whether or not the welfare programs that they were actually distributing were doing a good job for the people that they intended to help. And so he came up with a system, with a mechanism for how they could determine whether or not people were better off as a result of the money that they were distributing. And what he found was that the government agency didn't want to do that sort of research because their budget was tied to how much money that they were actually distributing. And so for Thomas Sowell, this is really an eye-opening moment for him, where he realized that the people working in these government agencies that had ostensibly been set up to help people, that the people in those agencies had interests of their own. And because their budgets were tied to how many people were working in the agency and how much money were they distributing, they had an incentive structure built into that government agency to just dole out more money. And for Thomas Sowell to come in and ask the question of, hey, are we doing more damage than good? It wasn't a question of whether or not it was good for the people they were supposed to be helping. It ultimately became a question of whether it was good for the people working in that agency. And that really started to sour him on this idea that government essentially has all the answers or the best answers. And so it led him down this path. And again, going back to that Free to Choose series that Milton Friedman developed, if you watch that, especially the older version, you'll see Thomas Sowell features very prominently because he started to do a great deal of work. Again, coming from a position of a Marxist and starting to look at, do these government programs help? Do the left-wing answers for what ails us as a society, whether it be discrimination, racism, sexism, income inequality, disparities, what are the best answers? And what I love about Thomas Sowell is it's not that he comes out there. He's a very, very rigorous academic. He believes in doing thorough research. He believes in testing theories across space and time. So he doesn't just look at, like, let's say, a welfare program within the United States. He looks at them overseas as well. He doesn't just look at things like maybe affirmative action in the United States. He looks at other countries and the affirmative action legislation they've put in place to determine whether or not it's actually achieving the desired results. And so when he talks about economic principles, not only does he do rigorous research on these, but he also makes sure that he explains it in a way that the layperson can understand. And that's going to lead me to the first book that I want to highlight for you all, and that is Basic Economics. So Basic Economics, there's been several editions of this. This is a great once over the world. So if you're wondering, like, how does the economy work the way it does? What are the principles of economics? He has this quote that he uses where he says the first law of economics is scarcity, that there's never enough to satisfy everybody's needs, wants, and desires. And then he says the first rule of politics is to ignore the first rule of economics. But if you were ever wanting to have a better understanding of economics in general, because it does, it affects so much of what we do. If you look at so many of the policies that go through, whether it's the federal government or your state government or your local government, you're going to find that overwhelmingly they address economic issues. And so I took it upon myself to say, you know what, I need to understand more about how prices work, how supply and demand works, how is wealth created. And basic economics is the primer. I'm just telling you right now, I know you're probably thinking to yourself, great, basic economics. If I have trouble sleeping, I'll read this. I can't just say it's interesting because the way he talks about things, the way he describes it, he doesn't use a lot of mathematics. He doesn't use a lot of charts and graphs that you would typically find in an economics class. He uses stories and examples in order to explain economic principles and why things work the way that they do, and essentially coming to the conclusion on why free markets are far superior to centrally planned ones. And so if you're looking for a good basic read, again, you don't got to do it all in one sitting, although I think I did because I found it fascinating, but just go through chapter by chapter. I'll give you one example of this. on a way that he explains something that I think most people take for granted. I was teaching at a homeschool co-op, and economics was one of the classes I was teaching, and basic economics was the book that I used as one of the textbooks. And one of the things I constantly repeated to my students is I would come in and I say, what are prices? What do prices do? And at the beginning of the school year, they didn't really know, but by the end of the school year, every single one of those students could tell you, every time I asked them, what do prices do? They'd always respond with, prices play a coordinating function within the marketplace. Right? And where did I get that? I got that through reading the examples of Thomas Sowell. Like, so for instance, a lot of people think that prices are set by businesses or prices are set by entrepreneurs. And it's true that they factor into why a price of something is what it is, but ultimately it's because of supply and demand issues. And one of the things that he talks about with prices and basic economics that is, I think, really insightful is the whole idea that if you need a pen or a pencil, right, you need some sort of writing implement, and you go to the store, right, and all you need, doesn't matter if it's a pen, doesn't matter if it's a pencil for this particular example. And all of a sudden you realize that pens are more expensive and pencils are cheaper. And so you decide to buy the pencil, right? The price informed you that if all you need is a basic, you know, implement for writing, then in this case, a pencil would be a better decision. Well, it's not just that that was a decision that you made based off of how it affected your life. You now sent a signal throughout the marketplace. Now, it might be that there was some sort of, you know, maybe there was a fire at a pen plant, right? And so there's fewer pens and that's why the price went up. Or, you know, maybe let's take the opposite example. Maybe there was a disaster at a graphite mine and that's why pencils are more expensive. You don't need to know all of the various things that went into why a pencil or a pen was a particular price on a particular day. You just need to know how much you've got to pay in order to accomplish what it is that you want. Right? And so you pay the appropriate price, and that sends a signal all throughout the marketplace with respect to where consumer demand is at. And that helps everyone from the pencil manufacturer to the person mining graphite, to the people that supply the paint to make the pencil yellow. You know, it informs all of them on where consumer demand is. So without having to be an expert in every single thing that goes into the production of a pencil, you make a simple decision based off of price, and then those prices send signals to the rest of the economy to tell producers what consumers really want and need. But again, there's so many good examples in basic economics. So I highly encourage you, if you want a good once over the world on the economy and how it works, basic economics is a place to start. Let's go to the next one. Wealth, poverty, and politics. This does a great job. So whereas basic economics kind of gives you an overall fundamental understanding of the economy, wealth, poverty, and politics really goes into more in-depth questions about how wealth is created, right? You see a lot of talk in politics about how do we distribute wealth? All right, well, that's great, but you can't distribute what you don't have. And so Thomas Sowell focuses a lot on how do you actually produce wealth in the first place. Now, for those of you who have been watching the podcast for a while, you'll remember that we did a podcast where we broke down this one very, you know, it was a left-wing video talking about income inequality in America. And one of the things that they started off with in that video was saying, you know, the total wealth of the United States is so many trillions of dollars. Now let's see how that's distributed. And one of the points that we brought up was, well, wait a second. You know, you're starting off with this assumption that there's just trillions of dollars of wealth in the United States. Does that mean when people showed up at Plymouth or Jamestown or when Native Americans first showed up to North America that there was just trillions of dollars laying around? And then the only question is, how do we distribute it? No, of course not. That wealth had to be created by people engaging in productive labor. Right, and Thomas Sowell focuses a lot on how wealth is created and how a lot of our political policy is focused on distribution without even understanding how wealth is created in the first place and how politicians, again, ignore that first rule of economics, which is scarcity, in order to just, you know, dole out money and to get elected. And he really goes into, you know, explaining how a lot of the programs that we see being pushed by government don't actually help the poor. One of the things I thought was so fascinating is where he looks at certain groups within the United States that have been specifically targeted as recipients for welfare programs. And what they do is they'll talk about what their overall standard of living is, but a lot of times they'll tweak the numbers in such a way as to make it look as if they've done a great thing. So maybe they'll talk about, well, after the Great Society and Richard Nixon, we saw a decrease in poverty. Well, Thomas Sowell takes those statistics all the way back to 1900 and says, well, wait a second, did your policy really stop poverty, or did your policy really reduce poverty, or were we already seeing a trend dating back to the 1900s? And the examples that he used and the numbers that he shares with us in these books is just phenomenal with respect to making the argument that, well, no, people were lifting themselves out of poverty because we had a free market economic system, not because there was a bunch of government programs. And in fact, if you look at how those government programs have affected people that were in impoverished conditions, you actually find out that it's stunted the overall progress that was being made by basically incentivizing destructive behavior or bad economic behavior. And so wealth, poverty, and politics is a great way to take the principles that he explains in basic economics and then to explain why it is, now that we know good fundamental principles, why is it that politicians oftentimes stray from those principles? And again, he does a great job of explaining that, well, there's political incentives to handing out other people's money. It's not that it achieves the best results for the poor. It's not that it achieves the best economic results. He also goes into explaining too how a lot of the, you know, not just solutions, but the symptoms, you know, Democrats a lot of times or leftists will come in and say that, well, poverty is a result of systematic racism, or poverty is a result of sexism or bigotry. And Thomas Sowell does a good job of saying, look, we're not discounting racism. We're not discounting bigotry. You know, clearly those things were used within the United States in order to prevent people, especially Black Americans, from being able to rise up economically. But he goes in and he says, but is this the best solution that we can offer? Is it a part of the overall answer, or is it the answer? And I can tell you from serving in the General Assembly, I can't tell you how many times people will bring up statistics, like carefully selected statistics, and then come up with the conclusion that, well, racism is what best explains wealth disparities. And Thomas Sowell just shatters that narrative in wealth, poverty, and politics. All right, let's talk another one. The Thomas Sowell reader. I will tell you, it was a sad day in America when Thomas Sowell stopped writing his articles. He used to write a syndicated column. I forget how many times a week it was, but he was a very prolific writer. Not only has he written a ton of books, but he wrote these weekly articles that were just a great kind of breakdown on what he called the passing scene. So he would take something that was going on in politics, something that was going on the news, something that was kind of taken for granted by all the powers that be, and he would really dissect it and provide a good explanation for why something was true, why something was false, or maybe why it didn't tell the whole story. And what the Thomas Sowell Reader is basically a compilation of all of those articles that he wrote, or I shouldn't say all, a lot of those articles that he wrote over several years. So if you're looking for kind of a good introduction to just Thomas Sowell's views, not just on economics, but on philosophy, politics, sociology, the Thomas Sowell Reader is a great one. It's one that you can pick up very easily, you know, read a couple articles, set it back down, pick it up again later. So if you're one of those people like me that sometimes has three or four books going at once, or you get busy with life and, you know, you're worried about starting a book and being concerned that you're going to lose a lot if you don't consistently read it cover to cover, the Thomas Sowell Reader is a great place to start. Next one, Dismantling America. All right, so this is one of my favorites. If I remember correctly, this was actually published, I think it was during the Obama administration, and he was again talking a lot about some of the specific policies that were being put in place, and he wasn't just talking about why they were bad economic policies. He was really digging into some of the fundamental problems with the mentality that was being created. And this is something that we've talked about before on the podcast, especially with our kind of talking about Theodore Dalrymple and his book Life at the Bottom. Theodore Dalrymple is the pen name for Dr. Anthony Daniels, and talking about how the welfare state doesn't just create it doesn't just fail to achieve the results it promises people, but it actually creates kind of a mindset of helplessness, or it creates a mindset which is counterproductive to a free society and allowing people to actually live their life the way they want and really make it everything that they want. And Dismantling America kind of tackles some of those philosophical issues as well as the economic ones. So again, another great book. Intellectuals and Society. Okay, this is, to be honest, this is one of my favorites. So the way Thomas Sowell defines intellectuals is he says that an intellectual is someone that essentially makes their living by talking about, discussing, or positing ideas, but they're not really responsible for implementing the ideas. And one of the things that he talks about is that it's important to understand this book is not anti-intellectual. in the sense that he doesn't want intellectual discourse. It's not that at all. What he's saying is that there is a growing number of people, especially within academia, that are paid very well to put forward and deposit certain ideas, but they're never the ones responsible for the results of those ideas. And a lot of times, policymakers and people that are responsible for passing laws or implementing policy, they go to these intellectuals. And what he finds so interesting is that if you were in the hard science, if you're a home builder and you keep building houses that are collapsing on the occupants, you're going out of business, right? You might even go to jail. But then he says with intellectuals, they can sit out in academia, put forward these ideas that policymakers then implement, you know, based off of the strength of this intellectual's, you know, argument or their status within society. And when that policy fails and when people are hurt by it, not only is the intellectual not fired, the intellectual is generally given tenure, right? They're given a cushy position, or they just move on to the next philosophy. And he talks a lot in here about people like John Maynard Keynes. I can't remember if he talks about Bertrand Russell in here, but he talks about a lot of other prominent intellectuals within academia that have put forth ideas that have either produced horrible results or have been demonstrated to not work in reality. And yet there's no consequence. And he talks about, in the economy, in you know, real life, for lack of a better term, if you're responsible for producing something or you're responsible for delivering a product or a service and you fail to do so, there is a price to be paid. But unfortunately, the way, you know, academia oftentimes works, you're actually promoted. Right? As long as you're repeating something that academia wants to hear or that certain left-wing elites prefer, then no matter how many times it fails, you can continue to do so without paying any consequences and in many cases actually being promoted as a result of it. So intellectuals in society is a good one, especially, you know, if you got some kids going to college and whatnot, intellectuals in society is a good one to read to kind of prepare them to go in with a mindset to say that, look, you know, my professor has a position of authority. They've you know, done work to earn that position, all right, but just because they have a degree or just because they're an intellectual doesn't mean what they're saying is accurate. And we should always, if you really believe in science and freedom of inquiry, well, then of course you should, you know, listen to somebody that has done a great deal of research on a particular topic. You should listen to the ideas that they put forward, but you should still use a critical thinking process in order to question the conclusions that they come to. And Intellectuals in Society is a great book for that. All right. Discrimination and disparities. Just like in Wealth, Poverty, and Politics, where he talks about the various things that contribute to wealth within society, discrimination and disparities is one where he really, really zeroes in on a lot of the most popular arguments that you see within political discourse now that attribute almost all income inequalities to some sort of bigotry, right? Sexism, racism, phobias, et cetera. And he goes in and he doesn't just look at, again, the United States. He looks all over the world. He takes into account things like geography. He takes into account things like two-parent families. He takes into account how many words are spoken around your children when you grow up. That was one that I thought was really interesting, how he was talking about, you know, in certain homes, a child will hear, you know, thousands of words a day, whereas in other homes, they hear very, very few, and how this affects their overall cognitive ability and whether or not it sets them up for success going forward. You know, he talks about everything, and this is in Wealth, Poverty, and Politics as well. He talks about how everything from, you know, geography does have some sort of effect on how wealth is created and generated. And one of the big things he talks about in discrimination and disparities that I think is very important is he essentially says that while everyone should be equal before the law, no one is equal with respect to, you know, their God-given talents or maybe their work ethic. Not that they can't achieve greater equality by changing their behaviors or circumstances or getting educated, but there's so many factors that go into explaining why a particular disparity exists. And so if you're wondering about things like gender pay gaps and arguments for or against the gender pay gap, discrimination and disparities is a great one. If you're wondering why it is that you see wealth continually accumulated in certain families and not in other ones, he goes into all the underlying assumptions and all the underlying reasons that provide insight. And again, his whole goal here is not to just shatter leftist doctrine with respect to discrimination. It's really about saying, look, if we're serious about wanting to help help people, then it's really, really important that we look at all of the underlying factors so that we can change our own behaviors in such a way as to set not only ourselves up for economic success, but our children as well and society in general. And so again, if you become frustrated that every time you don't like a particular tax increase, or every time that you think a particular policy is not achieving the end results, and you've always wondered, you know, where can I go and get some good data, some good stories, some good arguments with respect to explaining that, yes, discrimination has played a role in certain economic inequalities, but it's certainly not the best explanation in most places within the United States. And again, he doesn't just look at programs in the U.S. He goes to Sri Lanka. He talks about Malaysia. He talks about South America. So, you know, just a wealth of examples that are really easy to understand. I can't emphasize this enough. There are other people that have made similar arguments, but they've kind of overburdened their arguments, or their books or their papers were written specifically for an academic audience. And there's nothing wrong with that. But when it comes to taking those same principles and distilling it down into something that, you know, you're not a trained economist, right? But you still want to understand these basic principles. Discrimination and Disparity is absolute must read. I would say this is one of the most important ones you can read right now if you're looking at, you know, how do I argue on behalf of free markets in a world that is increasingly chalking up every sort of economic outcome as a result of discrimination or central planning. And then finally, charter schools and their enemies. This one's critical. I can't emphasize this enough, right? I know I've said that about a couple of these, but this one's critical because he really goes into making a great argument for why giving people, especially poor people, more educational opportunities is absolutely critical. And he really dispels some of the worst arguments that are used against providing greater academic opportunities for children. I mean, this goes back to, you know, at the end, who should be determining whether or not our school system is working? Because right now it's politicians. Right now it's politicians and teachers unions. They have the vast majority of the control over what your curriculum looks like, over what your school looks like, over what your child's education looks like, right? Unless you can afford an alternative. And he makes an excellent argument for why a lot of the different educational opportunities have not only improved the educational environment for students that needed it the most, right? Students that were growing up in poverty, that didn't have the same educational opportunities that a charter school really did great things for them. Or just, again, not just specifically charter schools, but any sort of educational choice. But he also talks about how it's ultimately better for teachers as well. It's ultimately better for society as well. Because when you have that environment where your education system is every bit as diverse as the student body that you're trying to appeal to, and when we really put the students and their parents back in charge as the consumers of education, you get better results. And it's not just better results for their educational life, but it sets them up for success going forward. So, as I said in the beginning, once you're done listening to this podcast, what are you going to do first? Well, provided you're not driving, you're going to like, you're going to give us a 5-star review, you're going to write a good review for us, right? I appreciate all of that because that, again, that is the currency of podcasts and YouTube, right? But then I want you to go and read some Thomas Sowell. Order one of these books. You can also go to a site called Uncommon Knowledge and you can search for Thomas Sowell interviews. They range from about 25 to 45 minutes. Reading Thomas Sowell is a delight. Listening and watching Thomas Sowell is even better because not only is he brilliant, he's also a bit of a smart aleck, and he's really fun to listen to. So once again, thank you for joining us on Making the Argument. I'm Nick Freitas, and we'll see you next time.
Once again, thank you very much for listening. If you want to support the show, again, one of the best ways you can do it is by heading over to goodranchers.com with promo code Nick. You're going to get $15 off. You sign up for one of those subscriptions and you're going to get up to $480 of free meat with that subscription. You get to pick top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, bacon. It is all up to you. Plus, if you're looking for gifts to get for the people that are impossible to shop for, goodranchers.com also has gift boxes. You need to act quick. This is part of their overall Black Friday special. So head on over to goodranchers.com, use promo code Nick, and once again, thank you for listening.